Happy Mother's Day, mothers and people that have been mothers to people, and condolences to people that have mothers that don't like them, you know? Mother's Days and Father's Days are always like kind of a mixed bag for some people. So when you're saying Happy Mother's Day, sometimes it's happy, sometimes it's sad. All those things. So every day is a Mother's Day. I'm glad you feel that way. Okay, so bad news, guys. I know you were really excited about having a sermon this morning, but during most of this series, we're not really doing sermons, mainly doing kind of a history lesson, you know, which is important because, as I mentioned last week, when we forget our history, we are often doomed to repeat it, right? Have mercy. And there's some ugly stuff there, for sure. And then also when we don't know our history, we often take for granted the amazing gifts that we've been given. We don't know who we are. We don't know where we come from. We make assumptions about ourselves, and we make assumptions about the world that just aren't true. And for Christians, a lot of times we lose touch with what an amazing gift that this like our world is still broken. But we lose touch with what an amazing gift that Jesus Christ has been in shaping our world. And shaping lives in our world. So, covering a huge bit of history today, flying through it. Thousand years. Yeah, flying through that. But so we can't do this well at all. So it's just going to be just kidding. So instead of trying to do a really great job of a thousand years, I'm just going to hit. What I've been doing every week in this is narrowing things down to like what I think is the very, very most important stuff to touch on, like what we have to know about this. And then I cut most of that out because it won't fit. This week what we're doing is just the three, as far as history goes, talking about the three biggest things that I think affected the church during this period of time, and talking about three great people. Painting with broad brushstrokes here. I'm leaving a lot of things out. If you want to talk to me about history and church history and things, I would love to talk to you about it. I have so much more to learn and more that I would love to share with you than what you guys will sit through. So, all right, the first one. First big thing that happened during this period of the three things is that there was a blending of Christianity and empire. A blending of Christianity and empire, or a blending of Christianity and state power. And this was huge, 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 huge. I said that. Yeah, that's a cultural reference now. It was a big deal. That was a Donald Trumpism. People were laughing in some ways. All right. Anyway, he says huge. It was a big deal. So in 313, as I mentioned last week, there's the Edict of Milan, and Emperor Constantine in Rome made that so that Christians were no longer an outlawed, illegal religious group. That means that they were not going to be hunted down, persecuted, killed, those sorts of things anymore. Constantine kind of sort of became a Christian, then he started showing favoritism to Christianity at this time, and then all the emperors after that did too. And this was a radical change. And I'm sure lots and lots of people that lived during that time were so grateful. And they probably felt like the kingdom of God was coming to earth. Because that meant that they didn't have to be worried anymore about their family members and about themselves being persecuted, about being killed. As you know, when we go to church today, are we going to be safe? Those sorts of things. Do we have to hide in the catacombs under Rome? So a big, big deal. But it came with its problems. It came with some big problems. One of the things that happened is that people started flooding into the church, and they started flooding into the clergy, because the emperor was showing favoritism to Christianity. And so, if you want to be in good with the emperor, then a good place to be is to be a part of the clergy. And temples to pagan gods were closed down, and cathedrals and churches were built. Most of the time, you know, Christians had met in hiding, or they'd met in little houses, and now they're meeting in churches and cathedrals for the first time. And so people began for the first time coming into the church because it meant wealth and power and prestige and position. Hey, I could be a pastor, and that's a somebody in this world. It doesn't mean that you're somebody with a bounty out on your head anymore. It doesn't mean necessarily a life of suffering and sacrifice. It means a life of comfort and a steady paycheck and all of those things. And that doesn't mean that all the clergy were bad. It just meant that it was a mixed bag. It was a mixed bag, and that it doesn't mean that corruption didn't happen in the church before, but it just meant that it was easier to happen now. And the huge problem that we have never gotten away from is this, is that all of a sudden when you blend empire and state power with Christianity, is all of a sudden both of these things use each other to gain more power. So the state, for example, can use Christianity to gain cohesion among people they're wanting to control. There's a guy named Charlemagne who uses this to conquer Europe. And he's not doing it out of love of Jesus. He's slaughtering lots and lots of people in Jesus' name because he's wanting to create cohesion and among a diverse group of people. So just like in the Roman Empire, where the worship of Caesar was used to create cohesion among a diverse group of people, and you could do whatever you wanted to do as long as you worship Caesar, because that means loyalty to the state. Now, that could also be used as a tool for emperors and the state to control people and say, you worship Jesus or we will kill you, or we will persecute you, or you have less rights. It also meant that the church could use state power to try to build the kingdom of God. It meant for the first time the option was there, just sitting on the table, to say, hey, I would like for you to become a Christian, and if you don't become a Christian, we'll have these people with swords stab you and kill you, or locked up, or your house burned down. Because that's state power. That's empire power. And so, for the first time, this group of people who had been enemies of the state were now had the power of the state so they could advance their own causes. And we can see in like the letters of Augustine and the writings of Augustine how this began to, just having this option on the table began to chip away at people. Augustine at first said, no, this is absolutely wrong. You cannot force people into becoming Christians. It has to be of your own free will. It would be completely against the God who honors our own free will and gave up God's life to honor our free will and to win us back instead of making us come back. And then a little bit over time, he gets to the point where he says, well, you know, I see how these people who have been forced at the point of the sword and suffering and persecution to become Christians, I see how they're now Christians. So I see some good in this. So maybe the ends justify the means. It's seductive, even for somebody who was a really great Christian leader like Augustine, for the most part. And one of the responses to this was that people also... This big shift is that people flooded into this thing called monasticism. They went out into the wilderness. They went out to the desert. Sometimes they stayed in the cities, but they separated themselves kind of from the world and from the big, powerful church in some ways. They created a little space there. Because they said, we don't know how to follow this Jesus who says if you want to be first, you have to be last. And the greatest has got to be the least. When there's a system here that makes whoever's the leader the greatest, we don't know how to do that. So we're going to go out and live lives of simplicity and service and sacrifice in different places and kind of separate ourselves because we don't know how to mix this all together. And for most of Christian history, the reforms in the church, our missionaries, our moral and spiritual leaders, they came out of the monastic movement. Does that mean that there was no corruption there? Absolutely not. But But these two things kind of played against each other, the church cathedral, the power, and the monastic move. That most of the reforms, most of the corruption, a lot of that stuff happened within the church, and a lot of the reforms came through the monasteries, but not the other way around. But not always. So it was a huge, huge thing, and the world has never been the same. Christianity has never been the same since then, since those two things were blurred and merged together. I'm rewriting some history here for some people, and that's okay. So ask me any questions you want to later on. I would love that. So the second one is the fall of Rome, and the rise of freedom. The fall of Rome and the rise of freedom. See, a lot of us, when we grew up in school in the textbooks, it said stupid things like Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, and he had a hard time getting backing because Columbus knew that the world was round, and other people said, "You can't go that. You're going to fall off the edge of the earth." That's absolutely not true. But it was in our textbooks, but, you know, not true. People knew Columbus was wrong about how long, big the world was. And other people who were right said, "Columbus, you're never going to make it to China with the amount of provisions that you can carry." And they were right. They just didn't know that and Columbus didn't either. They didn't know that there was North and South America there as a good stop on the way. But another thing that is wrong in our textbooks is that, and historians are coming around to this, but a lot of them all generally accept this anymore, is that when Rome fell, it didn't begin the Dark Ages. That you can even look this up on Wikipedia if you want to. There is no Dark Ages. It is a supposed, it is a misnomer. The idea was that when Rome fell, civilization fell, and then all of a sudden everybody in Western Europe became backwards, ignorant people that were living in muck and dung and forever until there was a resurgence later on. It's not true. What happened is that Western culture and the political center of gravity shifted from the south in Italy, and it shifted north to what we call, I'm using modern terms like Italy and Germany and France, but it shifted up to what the areas we know of Germany and France is today, and Sweden and Switzerland and those sorts of things. That the center of gravity for civilization in that area shifted north. And also centralized power, because you have big empire, shifted to decentralized power. So all of a sudden you have this, Rome is holding tyranny, empire, over all of these people. All of a sudden that's all broken up. So you have all these small kingdoms. And yes, they fight among each other, but Rome laid waste to lots and lots of people. So one of the things people say is that it was a bloody and violent time. All of history is a bloody and violent time. Hasn't been, you know, we're pretty lucky in world history to be living where we live and things. But it was decentralized. So you have all these kingdoms and things. And it led to a lot of progress and a lot of development, competition and ingenuity. And then the administrative, diplomatic, education, social services, all those things, they went to the church. So Rome had been handing out bread and circus. The church was the one, and the monasteries and things were educating people. They were administrating things. They were doing diplomatic services between these kingdoms and stuff. The church is what held this together. It wasn't necessarily Europe. It was more Christendom. Europe is an idea that came out of Christendom, but I'll mix those things up sometimes. So no Dark Ages, but this was an incredible, incredible time of advancement. Incredible advancement in agriculture, nutrition, animal husbandry, metallurgy, shipbuilding, navigation, mechanics, transportation, art, music, engineering, physics, architecture, education, astronomy, botany, economics, anatomy, chemistry, medicine, and geography. It was a time when people also began experimenting with ideas of limited government. It was a time when Christendom began taking technological and intellectual leaps ahead of the rest of the world. And what historian Jean Gimple calls one of the greatest innovative eras of mankind, the Dark Ages, one of the greatest innovative eras of mankind. And this was all while Western Europe was largely cut off from the rest of the world. It was largely cut off from the rest of the world. And why was it cut off from the rest of the world? Oh, and by the way, a lot of this innovation and stuff was happening because the church was creating universities and people were studying and things like that, educating people. And in some regards, the people that were studying in those universities had more freedom of thought than what people do in universities today. It's not what we think of, right? But it's true. We're supposed to think about, no new thoughts, we're going to kill you and burn you. That's what's supposed to be the Middle Ages. That happens sometimes. But for the most part, they had more freedom than what professors and people do today. And all this happened while Western Europe was cut off largely, not completely, but largely from the rest of the world. So what cut it off? The third of the three big things, the rise of Islam. The rise of Islam. So to understand this, we have to have another paradigm shift about the way that we typically look at the world. Because when we think back at history, we kind of think that Europeans have been the big dogs, like running the world for a long time. But it's not true. I mean, it's been a while. For most of the last 1,400 years, Europe and Christianity have not been the big dogs on the world scene. Islam has. Islam has had Europe and Christianity on the ropes for most of its existence. And Christianity was in danger of being annihilated, of being wiped out a number of times. Sam, go to the first map here. So in 622, Muhammad began, you can see on this map the orangish red stuff. Muhammad began conquering the tribes that were around him and most of the Arabian Peninsula there. And then within 130 years, Islam had conquered an empire that was three times larger than the Roman Empire ever was. And by the way, it took Rome 800 years of fighting and conquest to get to the size that of its largest size. But in 130 years, Islam conquered an empire that was three times larger than the Roman Empire ever was. When all was said and done, over 50 million Hindus were dead, 10 million Buddhists, an untold number of Zoroastrians, 20 million Christians, and somewhere over 100 million Africans. And some consider these conservative numbers. This expansion kept going and going and going. So one of the things that we've kind of lost touch with is that Christianity was not predominantly a European religion. We think Christianity, Europeans, white people, that's where it comes from. No, it comes from the Middle East. It is predominantly a Middle Eastern religion. But by the middle of the 700s, about half of all Christians in existence were wiped out. And half of all Christian lands were gone. Of the five major Christian centers, Jerusalem, Antioch, Constantinople, Alexandria, and Rome, only two were left. In Christian hands, and those two, which was Rome and Constantinople, were under constant threat. In fact, if it had not been for a victory in the Battle of Tours, you can kind of see it on the map, the arrow that is like almost to Paris. That's the Battle of Tours. Charles Martel stopped an invading Muslim army right there in 732, and then Constantinople was constantly under attack too, and it came really close to falling, both in 677 and 717. And if it hadn't been for those victories, Christianity and European culture would likely have been wiped out, because that was the only place. Go to the next map, Sam. So you can see on this one, maybe go to the next one. Let's see if there's another map. Okay, that's a bigger map of the world and of what happened there. So Christianity was getting pushed until it was, and not everybody that was up in Europe there, what we know of Europe, were Christians. So Christianity was getting pushed and pushed and pushed into this small corner of the world. If it hadn't been for those victories, Christianity would have been wiped out. Attempts at conquering Europe by Muslim armies continued up until 1683, where the Ottoman Empire, a Muslim empire, for the second or third time, brought an army to the gate, what's called the Gates of Vienna. Very few of the lands that were lost from Christianity were ever taken back. And the two that were, Sicily and Spain, it took over 250 years to win Sicily back. That's that little island. Go back, Sam. That's that little island at the tip of the boot of Italy. That was part of a little Muslim caliphate. And after 250 years of fighting, Christians eventually took that back. And it took 770 years to take the Iberian Peninsula back. 9 years for Muslims to take it over. 770 years of fighting to take it back. The Iberian Peninsula is the Spain, Portugal. So Western Europe was cut off largely from the rest of the world. They would still have commerce and things through the rivers, through the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea sometimes, and get over and communicate with other people that way, and with the Byzantines and things. But largely it was cut off from the rest of the world. Even traveling on the Mediterranean Sea was really dangerous, because there was a lot of Muslim pirates that were traveling the seas and taking out ships and raiding the coasts, both for loot, as pirates and raiders do. Think of like Vikings or something, but a lot of what they were taking was slaves. So during this period, over 1 million Europeans were taken out of Europe down to the through raiding and ship raiding and stuff, down to the Muslim slave markets, the Islamic slave markets in the Middle East and North Africa. The women were typically taken to be sex slaves, which was pretty common of all women who were slaves at that time. And pretty unique for Muslims was that the men were typically all castrated and made into eunuchs. Over 1 million people there. So that was traveling and commerce and communication and all those things around the Mediterranean Sea a pretty dangerous thing. Here's a paradigm shift for a lot of us that think have a very European centric view of history, is how could they get away with this? How could this happen? How could they conquer like an empire that's three times the size of Rome, and how could Christians be Europeans be hemmed in like that? Because they weren't as powerful. Because they weren't as powerful. Because they could, you know? Like, nobody was saying, oh, we'll let you, you know? Because they could. And nobody could stop them. Mm-hmm. Yep. And the decentralization. Good thing. Good transition. I should have worked that in a little. But that's almost a good... We're almost there, Sharon. So it would be difficult to minimize, to overestimate this movement's impact on the world and on Christianity. Those numbers kind of, you know, about size and millions of people and all those sort of things, they kind of hint at that a little bit, but it's just hard to overestimate this impact, the impact that this movement has had on the world and on Christianity. What the world would look like if Christianity was still largely a Middle Eastern religion. One of the ways that the threat of Islam negatively affected Christianity is the way that we responded to it. So, like Sharon said, Europe was very decentralized, a lot of kingdoms and things, small kingdoms, and the only thing that could pull all of these kingdoms together and all these people together to fight and resist Muslim invasion and fight for their survival was the church in Rome. Because there was no Europe. There was no, there was nothing that would hold people together of that whole of Christians there except for Christianity. And so the only thing that could hold it together and call those people to fight together for their own survival did. The church did. But it came with a cost. Christians, in the name of Christianity, went to war. And they went to war with Muslims, and through a series of campaigns and battles, around 1 million lives were lost and taken. Under the banner of Jesus and the cross of Jesus. And of these 1 million people that died, most of them were Christians, and most of them died of diseases, but 1 million lives were lost, and atrocities were committed, and very, very little was gained. Went on for about 200 years. But the greatest cost to the world and to us was this, that when we did this, when the popes and religious leaders and stuff rallied the fighting people of what we call Europe now, of Christendom, and said, quit fighting among yourselves. Go and fight for your own survival. Go and fight these infidels who are doing terrible things to people. When that happened, it further advanced the idea that the cause of Jesus could be pursued at the point of a sword. It further advanced the idea and even entrenched in us this idea, this belief that Christianity, Christendom, could be advanced with the tools of empire. That we could spread God's good kingdom by killing people. And even if it was ever right for Christians to go to war, in too many cases we fought like soldiers of Muhammad instead of followers of Jesus. Some people think that it's anachronistic, which means to take values and things from today. Somewhere else. Some people think that it's anachronistic to take like modern values of warfare and innocent civilians and things like that and stick them back in some other time, but I don't. Because our moral leader is back in history. It is Jesus. And so their rules of engagement should have looked, even if they were going to do that, should have looked more like Jesus, should have looked like rules of engagement tempered by the love and the mercy that we find in Jesus. We went to war, and those rules of engagement looked so much like the rules of engagement of their time and not at all like Jesus. People who had went to war as a last resort, loathing it and hating it, wishing for another way, longing to show mercy and love to the other. People who saw the image of God in their own foes and enemies. And soon sermons about God wanting us to go out of love of neighbor and go and fight the infidel in a foreign land, fight the Muslim invaders, became sermons about killing other Christians who had wrong beliefs, air quotes on that, and sermons about killing non-Christians who weren't even a threat. Far more than anyone else, it was Christians who paid the price for this terrible, terrible belief. of madness that would cost millions and millions of more lives than were ever lost in the Crusades, taken and lives taken, Christian lives taken by Christian hands. Things that we'll get into next week, things about the 30 years' wars and just slaughtering of other Christians who didn't believe the right things. These questions about how we treat people that are different than us, who believe differently than us, how we relate to the use of force, how we relate to the power of the state, how we live the way of Jesus in a violent world, how we love both our neighbor and we love both our enemy at the same time in a violent world. These are questions that Christians still wrestle with today. And by the way, we all too often still don't get it right. Still don't get it right. So three big things, and there's probably more, but the merging of state and Christian power, the merging of church and empire, the growth of freedom after the fall of Rome, and the rise of Islam. Three huge things. So now I want to just zoom in a bit and tell you about three people that lived during this time. People that are part of this great cloud of witnesses. There's a guy named St. Eligius. That's not the name that his mother gave him. Not the first name anyway. He was given that name after he died. But Eligius lived in the early 600s. He lived in France. He was a skilled goldsmith. Very well known for this. Very talented. He was an excellent businessman. He was a public administrator. But he later became known as a saint because of his love for God. All the years of his life, he was known to have had the Bible open on his desk wherever he worked, and he would read it as often as he was able, and he tried to live out the teachings that he found there. Since he was so talented and so good at what he did, he made a lot of money as a businessman, and he would regularly take whatever money that he made and he would go to slave markets and buy 50 or 100 slaves just to set them free. He would bury the bodies of criminals who would normally just be cast out somewhere. They didn't know how important it was to bury dead people back then. He gave to charities. He constructed monasteries. He gave and he gave and he gave and he served and he served and he served. When the local bishop died, Eligius was asked to take that bishop's place, though he had had no training in that. So he asked if they could wait for 2 years to let him get educated in what he would be doing. So he took 2 years and they held the position for him. And he basically went to seminary. And as bishop, Eligius led his people in mission work among his pagan enemies, caring for their sick and for the poor. The sick and the poor of people that were considered enemies. And many of these people eventually became Christians. Eligius lived a pretty long life for back then. He died at the age of 70 and became, for people of his day and for all of us, an example of what God can do with a life, just a regular life, devoted to him. A businessman, a craftsman, devoted to giving all that he had to God. God, we thank you for this life of Eligius, part of our great cloud of witnesses. Thank you for his life and his example. It's another lady named Hildegard of Bingen. Hildegard of Bingen. Sam, also write that one down, Hildegard, if you want to do any family planning. And Bingen's a good one too, you know, middle name, Hildegard. Okay. She was an exceptional woman. She lived in the 12th century Germany. From an early, early age, she kept having these divine visions, these visions from God. Some of them made sense to her, some of them didn't. But she continued to feel God speaking to her through these visions that she had all of her life. She founded a nunnery. She was a prolific writer. That's unusual back then, for sure. 1200s, prolific writer, woman. But she wrote in the areas of theology and botany and medicine. She wrote plays and poems, and she composed music. She was sought after for advice by popes and by emperors and by kings and monastic leaders. She led her nuns in finding better ways to care for sick people. She began using an early version of a scientific method, learning that, hey, you know what? When we boil water, people are less likely to get sick. When we boil water in our treatments of sick people and injured people, they're less likely to get disease and get sick. She studied herbs. A lot of people lived that otherwise would have died because of her. When she turned 60, I thought this was really interesting, she began a preaching tour. Interesting thing to take up. She left her monastery, her nunnery, and she began a preaching tour where she went to taverns and she went to bars and she went to universities and cathedrals and other monasteries, and she preached. She encouraged people in Christian faithfulness. She condemned public injustices, calling out officials and rulers and things. She spoke out against corruption in the church. This woman was so exceptional in so many ways, but the thing that shaped her life more than anything else was that Hildegard loved God and that God loved her. And that love shaped her life, not just in that she was a nun, but then how she was a nun. How she wrote, what she did with her gifts and the talents that God had given her. And she was a bright light shining in a dark world. So God, we thank you for this life of Hildegard, part of our cloud of witnesses. This one's kind of funny. 12th century, little earlier than Hildegard. A rich Italian merchant drags his son into the church to go and see the bishop, hoping that the bishop can straighten his son out. His son, for a lot of his life, has been living just like so many other rich sons live, getting into all sorts of shenanigans and things, and that he would be better off if he stayed away from, which his dad seemed to be okay with. He understood those things, but he didn't understand his son lately, because lately his son had been taking whatever he had and just giving it away to poor people. He began hanging out with lepers, and wearing sackcloth and begging with poor people, begging for food. It was a disgrace. It was a small town, relatively speaking. People knew who he was. It was a disgrace. The bishop couldn't straighten out this rich man's son. And the father became irate, and he said to his son, "Even the clothes on your back belong to me. You need to straighten yourself out and get yourself right." And so the son just looked at his father, looked at the bishop, took his clothes off, dropped them on the floor, renounced his inheritance, and walked out the door, leaving his father wondering what had gotten a hold of his son. The young man's name was Francis of Assisi. And what had gotten a hold of this young man, Jesus had begun stirring in Francis's life for some time. Stirring in his life, especially as he read the Gospels, and more as he began to see the face of Jesus on the poor people that he passed in the streets. More and more, the love of God began to fill Francis's life. And this desire to become a true follower of this Jesus that he was finding in Scripture and he was encountering in the world around him began burning in his heart. And Francis longed to care for people the way that his Jesus did. And for the rest of his life, Francis lived a life of voluntary poverty, caring for the sick, loving on lepers, preaching to people on the streets, preaching and speaking to people in power about their injustices and abuses, and taking up for victims that had no voice. In time, other people joined what he was doing and wanted to live their life like him, and a monastic movement was formed around his way of life. And though Francis had very little more than what he walked out of for the rest of his life, had very little more than what he walked out of that church with that church that day, Francis was known for his love and his joy and his compassion. He was known for just being a joyful, joyful soul, full of love. In a world where people preached about the God of fear, Francis taught and lived a message of this God of love. And through his example, so many people, then and throughout the centuries, have rediscovered the way of Jesus. People began to see their wealth and their life differently. They began to live differently. Francis was also a former soldier, son of a rich man, soldier. And at some point, he also sent missionaries into the Muslim world to live the way of Jesus before others. Almost all of them were killed for their faith, maybe all of them. I don't know of anybody that survived. And knowing about the Crusades that were still going on during his time, this time they were going on in Egypt, Francis decided to set sail and head to the battle lines of the Crusades in order to wage peace as best he could. He thought that if he could meet with the Sultan and he could tell him about Jesus, that maybe the Sultan would come to love the Jesus that he loved too, and that the war would be over. Francis went to where they were fighting, and when there was a pause in the battle, Francis crossed the lines and went to go and meet with the Sultan. They met for 4 days, and it's not really clear what happened during their 4 days, but they seem to have gotten along pretty well. The Sultan didn't become a Christian that we know of, not sure, but we think that he liked Francis pretty well. One thing we know for sure out of all of this, though, is that it illustrates Francis's belief that making peace requires risk and it requires sacrifice, and that waging peace is worth doing and it has a price that's worth paying. What we know is St. Francis later died of a disease that we're not sure what it was, but probably leprosy. But through his 16 years of ministry, people felt that they got to see the teachings of Jesus lived out in front of them through this single man named Francis. And other people said, I want to do that too. I want to do that too. I want to live differently too. I want to be a part of that. And it changed some parts about the church, and it changed people's lives, and it changed communities. It still is today. So God, we thank you for this life of Francis of Assisi, part of this great cloud of witnesses that you have given us. This is our heritage, the good parts and the bad parts. The stuff is still in us to be like Francis's of Assisi and say, God, I am following you no matter what it costs. Still in us to kill people and think that we can kill people to advance the cause of Jesus. Still part of us. It's our heritage and our family. It is where we come from. God, may we hear your voice echoing through all these years. May we hear your story. through all these cautionary tales. And through these beautiful examples. God, put that warning deep, deep in our hearts about that dangerous mixture of the power of the state, the power of empire, and the church. May we remember your words that he who would be first must be last, and the greatest among us must be least of all. May we live that out. We live in a world that's scary and that's dangerous, God, and we don't always know how to navigate that in the right way. But we can do better than what we've done. We can do better. May you create more St. Francis's and more Hildegards, more allegiances in this church. And may that start with me. We love you, God. Thank you for how you are growing your good kingdom by changing lives that change the world, one person, one heart at a time. Amen.